This episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast is brought to you with NFU Mutual, offering you tailored farming insurance and a local personal service.
That's one of the key things. A good agreement between landlord and tenant doesn't need a code, and it doesn't need necessarily everyone referring back to the agreement. It needs an understanding of what good looks like for both parties. So my role, I think, is to make sure we've got the balance across the piece and to make sure that I can see where things are working and where they're not.
A new tenant farming commissioner to oversee the relationship between landlord and tenant. We have a special interview with Alan Laidlaw. What can artificial intelligence offer the livestock sector? And we visit a special Future of Food exhibition at the Science Museum. Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
And we go straight to that top story. Former Chief Executive of the Royal Highland and Agricultural Society of Scotland, Alan Laidlaw, has been named as the first Commissioner for the tenant farming sector for England, fulfilling one of the key recommendations of the ROC review of the sector in 2022-23. Mr. Laidlaw's new role will be to act as a trusted and impartial point of contact for tenants, landlords and their agents to ensure fair practice and tackle poor behaviour across the sector. Farmers Weekly's Philip Clark asked Mr. Laidlaw what he wanted from a code of practice for tenant farming.
I'm keen to see it being adopted and lived and breathed. And ideally, what we would like to be in a position is where people just act in that way behind the, you know, in the spirit behind the code. It doesn't need to be at front and centre. It needs to be in the background of how landlords, tenants, agents, everyone in the sector behaves. And I think that's one of the key things. You know, a good agreement between landlord and tenant doesn't need a code, and it doesn't need necessarily everyone referring back to the agreement. It needs an understanding of what good looks like for both parties. So my role, I think, is to make sure we've got the balance across the piece and to make sure that I can see where things are working and where they're not. After that, I think that DEFRA are in a good place in terms of responsiveness to the sector. And I think that's the key thing, is if we understand what's working well, we see the code of practice being used more often, if it's in areas where it's not been working thus far, because if it's working, the code of practice will remain silent, and we go from there.
Do you see land agents as opposed to landowners representing either a different or greater challenge in the work that you face?
I don't actually. I see everybody in the chain as being essential. You know, you're only as strong as your weakest link. And if somebody's not looking in the best interest of the farm or the business or the tenanted sector, then that's the challenge. It's not one individual, whether they be tenant, landlord or agent or solicitor or any other professionals, because there are actually quite a lot of other professionals that other than land agents that influence the enjoyment or the success of a tenancy. And I just want everybody, rather simply, being on the same rope in the same direction. Where we get people entrenched in different views and outcomes, it's very difficult. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that people don't have different ambitions for the same piece of land, and that's where, you know, the behaviour comes into it. You know, if there's a substantial change on a piece of land, it affects lots of different people's interests. And I think a lot about the code of practice is how it's done. It's not necessarily changing the overall outcome, but it's probably affecting the process. And that's not just land agents, it's everybody in that chain.
That's newly appointed Tenant Farming Commissioner Alan Laidlaw. Louise, this appointment, a long time coming.
Yeah, it has been a while, hasn't it? And as you say, no, it's been very warmly welcomed. So that's a good sign, isn't it? This is the first ever Tenant Commissioner, and we know what the tenanted sector has been going through and how they're feeling, and I would say they're feeling quite threatened in certain places. So to have somebody on their side and to have somebody as strong and as good as Alan, I think will be very, very reassuring to them.
It is a time of change. I guess his job is to ensure fair play.
I think that's exactly what it is. And probably it's important just to say that it is non-statutory, his role. So he's going to have to work really hard, I think, to have the influence that he needs to have and to be able to impact the sector. But that's something that I'm sure he's quite capable of doing. I think I'm right that the Tenant Farmers Association, that they did a survey which showed that 30%, which is a high number, isn't it? 30% of tenant farmers felt that they were being bullied or harassed by their landlord. So, you know, that's quite a figure, and it certainly gives him something to get stuck into.
That 30%, that is a high number, and surprising in one way and yet not in another. But we know that when landlord-tenant relationships work really well, it benefits everybody, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does. And there are some fantastic examples out there. And I think we have featured a couple on the podcast in recent months. But yeah, when they're working well together, they are really, really working well. I suspect that that figure, that 30% figure, I suspect that's probably gone up in the last year or two, as, you know, as we're seeing this massive change that the whole farming sector is going through. I can't be certain of that, but I suspect that's the case.
And Hugh, do you think Alan Laidlaw can achieve everything that's needed to be achieved to make this whole thing work?
Well, let's hope he does. Otherwise, there's absolutely no point having him there, is there, quite frankly? There's a fair bit to do, isn't there? There's still stuff to, I suppose, people are still trying to get their head around the whole, I suppose, landlord-tenant relationship in a more eco-friendly way, in the sense that obviously there's a lot of stuff going on where people are either being pushed out of tenancies because landlord might want to do a solar development or something like that. There's not a lot you can do about that. But I suppose it's trying to encourage more collaboration going forward on some of the other greening things. And actually just the bread and butter stuff of day-to-day agriculture, isn't there? Because, you know, there's always improvements to be made from either side of the tracks, really. So look, anything that gives more clarity, anything that I suppose gives people, I suppose, you know, gives both parties skin in the game in terms of negotiating going forward, it's got to be a good thing in terms of long-term outputs. And let's face it, the best landlords generally have that, you know, would obviously have the happiest tenants. Generally, when you walk onto farms like that, you know, the thing is moving in the right direction. So for everybody, it works. But look, there's challenges there. Let's hope he's a czar that can move stuff forward and, you know, his value for money in terms of what he gets paid to do it. And I'm sure, look, if anyone, the tenants forums and the TFA and all of the tenants are going to be the first to call him out if he doesn't perform.
Well, we have seen situations where tenants have been let go, to put it kindly, as landlords have taken back farmland in hand and decided to, well, in some cases rewild it, but in some other cases put it into environmental schemes. Not much farming or less farming going on, less food production farming going on than there has been in the past.
Yeah, that is the case. I mean, you know, we've all heard of farms being taken back by landlords, and they have been, to be fair, for a real variety of reasons. And, you know, as I've already said, there is so much change going on at the moment. But, yeah, some people, I think, have been probably very badly treated, and it'll be really good to have a commissioner in that role and somebody who, you know, can help with some of these really sad and difficult cases.
A big welcome then for Alan Laidlaw, but he has got a serious job to get stuck into, Hugh.
Yeah, he has got a serious job to do. And this is the first, you know, commissioner of tenancies. And like you say, it's something that George and the TFA have been lobbying for many, many years. You know, as lobbying organisations go and for what they do, you know, the TFA do a pretty damn good job. And many of their members will tell you that they really do. You know, they really do knock it out the park in terms of what they do. For a small team, they make a big impression. So this is obviously good news for them because they've been lobbying this for this for a long time. But as I said, you know, if this person doesn't deliver, if Alan doesn't deliver what they think he should deliver, they're going to be the first to call him out. But look, the good thing is they've got someone in place. There was a whole load of stuff in that ROC review from a few years ago And there's more presumably to come in terms of what's pushed out. And it's the sort of things that the new tenants commissioner will be able to pick up on, you know, even if these recommendations aren't fully in the sort of statute yet or being observed yet. It's hopefully he'll be gunning for the tenants on that side in terms of getting this stuff across the line. So there's a lot of work to be done. And the tenancy stuff over the years, you know, it goes in fits and starts, doesn't it? There's, you know, obviously had the 95 Act, there was the 70s, the 86 Act, then the 70s. It takes a long time and not much really has changed since the FBTs came into place. In terms of the structure and the framework. And for some people, that works really well. They like the framework. They like the structure. They like the fact that it's flexible. But then for many people, you know, despite all of that, there are plenty of tenants there who still, you know, feel they're getting a bit of a bum deal compared to others. And indeed, just to balance it off, there will be landlords as well that feel that they're the wrong side of wherever the tenancy is. So there's lots of work always to be done in this area. And let's forget, you know, not forget, a huge majority of farmland or a huge chunk of farmland is tenanted. You know, it could be mixed tenants. There are some people running farm businesses we know who are all they are is tenants. They don't own any land at all, other than a house they may live in or something like that. So it's a huge part of what we do day to day. So it needs sorting out. Good luck to Alan, and let's hope he does what he says on the tin.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, with farm conference season upon us, barely an event goes by without at least one session about artificial intelligence in agriculture. It has, of course, much to promise, but a whole day to discuss artificial intelligence? Well, that's exactly what took place this week at the Science Museum in London. Called AI Live, the event explored the potential for artificial intelligence in livestock production. I went along and caught up with a few of the conference delegates, starting with farm vet and conference co-organiser Matt Dobbs.
There's a huge spectrum, a huge variety of applications of AI, from farmers that are deeply embedding some of this technology into their processes and their management, right the way through to farmers at the other end that know very little about it or are even scared about what that technology might mean for them. So there's huge changes and huge opportunities ahead for us to bring more education, for us to help the industry understand the application, and finally to make sure that the standards of AI are common across our industry so that every producer, the I in AI we say is about people, so every producer can benefit from this technology in the future.
So you've got a fair turnout here. What better place to hold it than the Science Museum? People from right across the industry. What have you learned?
Yeah, well, we're super excited with the event. We've got literally the full spectrum of the industry here, from, you know, very importantly, producers, dairy, beef, sheep, poultry, swine, pig, right the way through to those that are advising from feed and veterinary, through to the wider industry, including the supply chain, right the way through to retailers. And we've learned that ultimately this is about the eye, the independence and the person is the heart of AI. And unless we get that right, the artificial application, the artificial intelligence won't be brought to bear. So it's all about really about people and making sure that they feel included as part of this future revolution. And we know from AI that its ability doubles every 3 months. So that's the sort of advancement in technology that we're talking about. And so just as we're seeing an increase in the rate of new agricultural industries, we're definitely seeing that with AI.
So David Spella, I'm from Derbyshire, from a company, Optifarm Limited, and also a poultry farming business, Applied. So what we're doing is we're taking data that exists on pig and poultry farms now around the world, so your environmental controls data, your water meter data. We're tracking the animals' routines for a few days and then predicting what they're going to do today before they do it. If they don't do what they've done, we interrogate why. And I think that's a really important part that AI can help us with, is understanding why did those animals do what they do? Whether they became sick, whether they grew really well, grew really badly, why? So what we do is a lot of cross-correlating of data really efficiently with artificial intelligence, and then try and understand why. The final piece we then do is, how do I get that in the hands of livestock farmers who love animals and hate data? So we use large language models to feed it in, put the numbers in, and what you get out is words that people can understand.
And that's going to have a benefit, I guess, from an efficiency point of view, from productivity. It's going to benefit the farmer, benefit the consumer.
It's all over because we work on productivity. Yes, that's where we started. But it turns out that isn't what sells this stuff often. We then went into the health space because we see what we call sickness behavior. So animals change their routines the moment they start to get sick. You can detect that. You can detect how well the humans look after the animals because good stock persons put animals in good routines, which means they're highly predictable. When they break those prediction models, you can start to link that to how well the staff are looking after them. And then you start to learn things around body rhythms, 24-hour circadian rhythm. And you can bundle all of this together to get a whole new perspective on welfare. So we're doing productivity, health, welfare, the whole supply from what is really water meter data, temperature, humidity, feeding regimes, some very basic information.
I can see a lot of our Farmers Weekly podcast listeners will probably be thinking, yes, I can see this working in a pig and poultry situation.
Yep.
Is it also going to work in something like beef and sheep?
Yeah, so sheep possibly more challenging because of the extensification. Certainly within beef and dairy, anywhere where an animal has a routine, you don't have to use water meter data as the trigger. You could use motion detections, you know, collars, ear tags, whatever. Anything you know your animal's doing a routine means you can predict them breaking the routine. Once you've done that, you know something's changed. Then you just cross-correlate everything to find out what changed and how does that help me understand the cause. That's what we do as farmers. Oh, hang on, why is cow 37 coming in at the back of the herd when she's normally in the middle? Let me go and check. You're just using technology for those sorts of things.
And you're using words to describe what's going on rather than this being a system that just spews out a load of data and numbers.
Well, I think there's an element of that. But I think if you just take it back to the basics, that I would absorb a lot more information from a documentary, David Attenborough wildlife documentary on TV on a Sunday night, than I would, bless them, my school teachers when I was at school. If you can turn information into entertainment, that's a much better way to get stuff across to people, particularly those that I would class right brain thinkers, love animals, probably don't like data. So what we want to do is turn it more into entertainment, and it's much easier to absorb. Again, language models, auto podcasting, news reels of the future, these can all be used to make it entertaining for you.
I'm Sophie Throop. I'm Technical Sustainability Director for Mitan Food Group.
Sophie, you're here in an almost observational capacity, seeing what's going on. What have you found out?
Well, I really love this topic and this industry. I mean, I used to work with vets. I worked with vets for about 9 years, so it always feels a bit like coming home. But also, you know, the power of data is just immense. And thinking about AI is something that I've just been at the World Agritech Centre conference for a day and a half. And it's now just a conversation we're all having, you know, because we're all using AI for our Google searches and everything else. So it's so different from how we were a year ago. And thinking about all that data is on farm and how can AI help just get to the root of what we need to do rather than just as swimming in data is super interesting. So I've really enjoyed it.
There seems to be lots of opportunities, obviously lots of interest here today. How do you see it working in the interface between, I guess, the farm gate and retailing?
Yeah, so I think it's just at the moment looking and listening and understanding a bit more, because I just am really attracted to AI from its time saving capacity and its also ability to try and get to the root of the issues, or you know, the actions that need to follow. So I think at the moment we're definitely I'm listening and learning a lot, but I think it is so powerful, and I'm just conscious that there's a lot of sectors have already got there and got on board. So actually, how can we play our part in the supply chain to encourage farmers and everybody to not be worried about it, but to embrace it and to see it as a positive about how to go forward rather than something to be worried about and feared.
Just some of the voices there from the AI Livestock Conference at the Science Museum in London. Hugh, you were at this conference. You were there. You were on a panel sitting on the stage there answering questions. Also there for the podcast, though. What did you make of it?
The take-home thing for me is there's a load here that AI can do and is already doing in lots of cases. Some really interesting, I mean, obvious things. The guy from Oxbury Bank, when he stood up and talked about how they've got AI systems working in the background, the one for me was the fact that if someone applies for a loan before you know, an accountant would manually go through it, look at it, and then it might take a day to get it right. It would cost the business 60 odd quid. And he put this slide up which says, you know, 24 hours and £60. Now the AI machine does it and it produces a one-page dashboard that a human can check off, and it takes 2 minutes and costs us 10p. So that's sort of a brief world or a brief glimpse into why, if you're leaving school or in the process of working in some form of middle management, where you have to check lots of stuff and it's fairly numerate, that you might not actually have a job in 10 years' time. The flip side is that there's a whole lot of stuff where this can really help in terms of analytics of data, and it's diving into the minutiae and the time it saves diving into the minutiae, looking at the data, looking at all the small bits that you would otherwise miss, and actually picking up all the correlations and all the bits like that which you would have missed otherwise.
Louise, AI, of course, also used in the arable sector, not just livestock.
Oh, yes, absolutely huge potential. And I mean, that point that Hugh was just making about data, you know, if you can actually ask questions of your data and get some insights, that's what it's all about. You know, we know that farms have been storing up data, whether it's yield maps, whatever, for really quite a long time, but not really being able to make massive use of that data. So this is where, you know, AI can really come in and give them the insights from all that information that they've collected. I mean, obviously, it also can take on some of what we call the boring tasks, the repetitive ones, the form filling type things that have to be done. And there will, I'm sure it already has a role in sort of measuring and monitoring things, say in crops, it perhaps disease levels or whatever, which again is repetitive but needs doing and understanding. So yeah, huge potential for it. I suppose the one thing that I would just mention is that farmers themselves often need localized, very localized advice. So if you're going to use AI to start, you know, giving you recommendations, advice, you do need to understand, you know, where it has been trained, if you like, or where that's come from and on what data, because you can get caught out. And I mean, there have been instances, I think, where, you know, you put in for what can I do about controlling this weed or this selection of weeds, and the advice that comes back is actually illegal in this country, either because we don't have those products anymore or that we're just not allowed to use that product at that timing or whatever it may be. So, that localized bit, I think, is really quite not a downside as such, but you just need to understand a bit more about that.
Yeah, you do. I think the key thing here is it's the old computer science saying, garbage in, garbage out. So if the resolution of what the input data that's going in is really ropey, it doesn't take into account the location, or you've got a reduced number of sample points for your disease or for your animal infliction or whatever it is, then you're going to get pretty ropey output. But I think that it's like everything. The more, the better you feed it, it's like, you know, if you're feeding a plant or feeding a cow, the better you feed it, the better it will do. So it has got huge potential. Look, it's already running in the background of loads of stuff. The one thing, again, actually referring back to the guy from Oxbury, said in their scenario within the financial sector, the big thing for them is, yes, whilst they've developed these systems themselves in their business, the key thing is there is still a human sense checking and calibrating. And that would be the same if you're in an animal system, wouldn't it? You know, you've got you have a robot milking parlor now, a robot milking setup now, but you still need a human. You know, when the automatic scraper falls off the edge of the concrete platform and into the slurry pit, the human's still got to pull it out. You've still got to reset the machine. And actually, you can have all of the stuff going on in the background you like, feeding the cattle or the chickens or whatever, but you still need someone that's a good stock person to go in there and say, yeah, they look great, or that one doesn't look so great. So it's an interesting thing. It's really important. And actually, what's really important, I think, is that everyone gets their head around what it can deliver within their own business context and makes an effort to learn. Because there was a survey that was presented earlier in the day, before you got there, Johan, and it was a big sample size of farmers, good demographics, so good crop reference, you know, 18 to 65, and about 10% were all over it, as you'd imagine. There was 13, 15% hadn't got a Scooby. And then there was a massive chunk of 40-odd, 48, 49% who had heard about it but didn't know what it was. And I think we'd be daft, any of us that are thinking, forward-thinking business owners, producers, not to pay some attention to it.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can also message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88440. Louise, some really interesting reaction to last week's podcast. Growers ripping up their autumn cropping plans and thinking differently because of the challenging season that we've had. People particularly taken with the idea of giving up winter wheat completely, and also perhaps giving up break crops too.
Well, yeah, I know. It did cause, I've had some feedback on this and it has caused more discussion. And of course, you can't give up everything, can you? You know, this, as I said last week, I have never come across this before where people are saying, am I really going to drill wheat? You know, given what the commodity prices are like and what they know it's going to cost them. And yeah, as I said last week, it has caused some head scratching, still is, and people have got to decide what to do. But it's a really, I think this is a really unusual situation. As I said, I can't remember when we've had that discussion before, but there are situations, and as I said, it's different on different farms, but there really are situations where growing wheat this year doesn't float their boat. And difficult to know what they will do, but there you go. It's caused a lot of feedback and a lot of discussion.
Including from non-farmer listeners as well. I've got an email here from Stuart Kelly who says, I'm not a farmer, just a small-time amateur gardener. When many farmers have reported failed crops this year, I've had my best ever harvest of fruit and veg. I don't understand why this should be the case. Is it my choice of fruit, or could it be that in spite of the drought and hose pipe ban, I've still been able to keep my plants happy with my tanks of rainwater? There is that as well, isn't there, Louise? I mean, if you've got irrigation, if you've got a reservoir full of water, you've been in a better position than other growers who just don't have access to irrigation or an abstraction licence.
Yeah, that's right. I think he's just answered his own question there, really. You know, he was able to water his vegetables and fruit every day. They then, of course, benefited from lovely sunshine, which, you know, we always need a certain amount of sunshine to get these yields and get these crops. So he's been able to, give them very good conditions. And that, of course, isn't always possible on a broad acre scenario.
Hugh, wheat not the only crop that people are not happy with. Challenging maize harvest as well.
Yeah, really challenging for lots of it. Some really good maize out there, but also there's a heck of a lot. We had pretty poor maize this year, I'm afraid. Didn't quite get enough moisture. We missed the critical bits of rainfall. And it's not been great. But then there are some places where it's been absolutely fine. It's just really, really variable. Your point about irrigation, absolutely. But I think the key thing with the irrigation thing is that, you know, remember, only less than 5% of UK farmland is irrigated. So it's not surprising that most people are in that boat. And then the point about wheat not going in over cover crops, I suppose, in a bizarre world, I suppose it shows in some ways that if the payments are there for the cover crops, people are getting into that one. But equally, the fact that there isn't a long-term plan in terms of support plan for food production in this country, however that support may come, people are just walking away from it. And which is doing exactly all of the things we've been saying for years would happen if the support plan broke down, which at the moment it seems to be in the sort of process of doing.
Yeah, and of course, we'll be watching developments with interest here on the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Hugh, this week's markets, what's happening?
Thank you very much, Johan. Finished their dead weight this week, just nudges up 641.5. It's gone up just under a penny on the week. The live weight, 354.4, that's dropped back about 9 pence on the week. Sheep rings, dead weight SQQ this week goes up 10p, 670.2. The live weight goes up 3p, 310.4. Pig price gone up 0.1 of a penny, 206.7. And then onto the arable markets, the usual absolute jamboree of joy. Not feed wheat 162.40. That's actually gone back about 50p on the week. Milling wheat spots in at 178.70. That's gone back 30p on the week. Feed barley has actually gone up marginally, £144.40, up from 142.9. Raw seed rape also sees a bit of a nudge upwards by around about 6-7 quid, 399.70 on the all seed rape. I suppose take some cheer from the fact that a year ago it was £380.70. So there you go, you're nearly 20 quid up on the year. Feed peas, 223.6. That is up about £9. Feed beans, 214.9. That is up £4 on the week. Diesel price stands on this week, 68.6, exactly the same as last week. And believe it or not, it's only 3p more expensive than a year ago when it was 65.4.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, the AI Live conference we reported on earlier in this episode was held at the Science Museum in London. Now, the Science Museum is also showing a major exhibition at the moment on the future of food, looking at how science is creating more sustainable ways of producing and consuming food across the world. It's a free exhibition featuring more than 100 historic and contemporary objects, from 3,500-year-old bread to McNuggets and cricket burgers to cell-grown salmon. It includes lots and lots of stuff about agriculture, examining inventions such as liquid ammonia and synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, through to pesticides and meat substitutes. Hugh and I wandered downstairs at the Science Museum to take a look. And if you look at this this bit of the exhibition here, you've got huge, not quite floor-to-ceiling photos, black and white photos, dying fish, rainforests that have been cut down, fertilizer production, chimneys belching smoke into the atmosphere. And there's this, there are these three digital counters that are counting the number of hectares of forest that are cut down, the tons of pesticides used, and the tons of fertilizer used as well. And obviously they're well into their millions.
Yeah. I get it spelling out the picture, but there's no acknowledgement that it's been... To be fair, actually, there is the Henry Dimbleby quote on the wall that says the Green Revolution was both fraught with miracles and fraught with danger. But it is saying, yeah, the reason you've got really loads of really cheap food, you know, it spells out the whole environmental impact. It doesn't acknowledge the fact that, you know, people are spending a fraction of what they earn now on food compared to 50 years ago. This is not a balanced view of... I mean, it paints a really good picture about where we have gone wrong with, you know, over-intensification, and, yeah, there's a valid argument there. But in terms of the future, it's like, I don't know, there's not much mention of much in the way of livestock production. We're all going to eat cell-grown meat and powdered protein.
I think they've set up the problems and the challenges that we face really well in terms of the environmental impact of farming. But there's a lot of that, isn't there? It's all about war on pesticides, fertilizer, global warming, etc. But there's not much stuff on the answers and the possible solutions.
No, it's all the negatives, and all the solutions are all about plant-based, or you could be part of an organic veg cooperative based in Hackney, and that's going to change your life. Well, not many people have got time to do that. It's a bit wonderful. But like I say, perhaps if we got a couple of million quid's worth of NFU money together, we could have put on a whole different display, couldn't we?
That's the Future of Food exhibition at the Science Museum. Hugh, you seemed visibly shocked when you with this exhibition.
Well, it was a bit of a... Yeah, it's not exactly subtle in terms of its agenda. Firstly, if you're in London, pop in and have a look and make your own mind up. It's in the Science Museum. It's on the first floor, and it's free to go into. But there's some great history bits in there. It talks about the harbour process and, you know, the revolution that was nitrogen coming as fertiliser. Talks about the Green Revolution. and how much that was. And we know that the bits of that were fantastic and bits of that were a hindrance. It's pretty doomsday, though, in the sense that there's this one piece you walk through and it's like X thousand tons, X million tons of pesticide and X million tons of fertilizer. And then also at the back of your mind, you're thinking, yeah, okay, we know that's happened and it's had an impact, but it's also meant that you've been able to only spend 8% or 10% of your household income on food and buy crap that you don't actually need, like posh cars, and go on holiday to places you never thought you'd go. So it doesn't really balance it off very well, I don't think, anyway. But then it's probably because I'm a grumpy old farmer going in there.
Louise, there was a lot of stuff about the bad things about agriculture, but there wasn't much about the good stuff. There's not, farming has moved on since the days of DDT and the 1960s.
Oh, it's made absolutely huge progress, hasn't it? And what a shame that they've obviously missed the story out. I mean, I haven't actually been to this exhibition yet, but I'm now mindful to go. It sounds, I don't know if this is the right word, it almost sounds quite lazy, what they've put together. It was supposed to be showing innovative solutions. That was something that they suggested that was going to be full of. But if it's just farmer bashing and farming bashing, then I'm not really sure what it's going to achieve.
There is a lot of that. I mean, this sort of doomsday, digital doomsday clock, or these three digital doomsday clocks ticking. You do walk through that. I think there are innovative bits in there, but I think it's the general emphasis that there is so much about the environmental impact of food production, but not so much about the way forward and the future.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think the one thing is, I mean, it paints this picture of the animal bit in there. It's got one piece and it's got like a model. It's like a mock-up model of an intensive barn. And it's got, cows in there and chickens in there, all in this one little barn. And then there's like a box, like it's like a Britain's toy farm type presentation. And then it talks about how intensive farming, is really bad and da-da-da-da-da. There's just no acknowledgement of the massive advances that have been made. It then talks about cell-grown meat and stuff like that, but doesn't talk about the fact that most of the cell-grown meat companies are almost bust because no one actually wants to buy into it. There's some really good bits I liked, but that probably reflects me being a grumpy old farmer. I love the retro bits on the wall, the old Roundup adverts from 1979 I remember seeing on the back of the Farmers Weekly as a kid. I mean, there's stuff like that there sort of painting this doomsday picture. But I think it'd be fair to say, Johan, that this was not funded by the NFU. This was funded by, clearly, some philanthropic pot with a very clear agenda that animal agriculture isn't part of the solution.
Well, yeah, it was funded in large part by the Jeremy Collar Foundation, and that's a philanthropic foundation, as it were, that aims to create, as it says, positive impact on critical issues, focusing on animal agriculture, education, and pensions. And if you delve a little bit more into that, that funding and the aims of the Collar Foundation, it seeks to address the consequences of, quote, intensive animal agriculture and drive the shift to a sustainable food system. Now, I think we all want a sustainable food system. Who wouldn't want that? But if you go to the, for example, the space exhibition in the Science Museum, it's all about the achievements of humankind in terms of space exploration, going to the moon, etc., etc. There's not very much, if anything at all, on the negatives in terms of atmospheric pollution from rocket launches, hazardous space debris, the use of resources for manufacturing space rockets, and all of the nitrogen oxide and soot and everything else, all the bad sides of space exploration. But there was a lot about the bad sides or the negative sides of the environmental impact of farming, Louise.
Well, it's just a real shame, I think. I think they've missed an opportunity with this exhibition. On the website, it says it's all about how food must change to protect the planet. So I guess that's a roundabout way of them saying, intensive livestock production is the baddie in the room. Now, we all know, don't we, about the progress that's been made with more sustainable farming methods and practices. There's an awful lot being talked about them, not just in the farming media and press, but much wider than that. So really, the organisers of this exhibition, there was plenty of material that they could have included, but it sounds to me as though they've been really quite selective. And I think... I don't think the public will be actually too fooled by that, because anybody who's interested in where their food comes from and how it's produced does tend to keep up to date with what's happening. So, yeah, as I say, I think they missed an opportunity, and what a shame that is.
To give them a bit of credit, there was a video running of some sort of controlled grazing of some sheep, which sort of said that you can do livestock sustainably. It's all a bit off the. It's all a bit off-piste and a bit utopian when they say, "Oh yeah, the solution to vegetables is you can all be part of an organic vegetable circle in Hackney," which sort of, you know, makes out that everyone's got time to be part of the organic vegetable circle in Hackney. And the one other thing that I will give them some credit for, there's a game that you can play in there. It's a bit like sort of a fairly brutal version, a simplified version of SimCity, where you can sort of pop. You can choose different production methods and you slide them across onto this fictitious island on like a computer screen. And then it has a dashboard which shows how much, you know, how much it's yielding and how much impact it's having on climate and nature. And I was expecting the, well, I can't remember how it's called on there, sort of the climate friendly utopian organic veg farm option to be the one that does the most. And to be fair, they have got a genetically modified mixed cereal farm type option as opposed to a monoculture one. And actually, to be fair, the genetically modified one does actually yield the most and have the least impact on nature. So it's not completely one-sided, but yeah, it is a bit. If you were a naive member of the public going in there with absolutely, which let's face it, most of the public are pretty naive about where their food comes from. Yeah, it's a pretty different picture to the one that we try and tell members of the public is happening in reality on farms versus what's happening in this exhibition. But do go and check it out, because it'd be great to get everyone else's feedback.
And that's it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. We do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've really enjoyed what you've heard, please do leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with all the latest news, views and analysis of all the big stories affecting UK agriculture. But for now, until next week, I'm Johan Tusker. Thank you for listening. This episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast was brought to you with NFU Mutual, offering you tailored farming insurance and a local personal service.